high and a hoo.
All right, good morning, y'all. This is Brother A-Dub, and you are on Higher Ground. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. I just can't get enough, y'all. Stevie Wonder, Higher Ground. All right. Ton of stuff going on, of course, in our country, in our community. I always want to encourage folks to get out and enjoy the day. So hopefully you'll get out and go to the farmer's market this morning after you're done listening to Higher Ground. Get on over there and get you some fresh produce, some locally grown stuff on the parking lot of Lincoln Square Mall on Vine Street in Urbana. So please get over there and get to the farmer's market and get you some good stuff. Nothing like a little healthy food. So listen, I want to get straight into some stuff here. I'm going to do a couple of announcements of some things that are going on. But then I want to get into this topic. The main thing that I want to talk about this morning, of course, is the situation in South Carolina in Charleston, the shootings that took place in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, an AME church in South Carolina, where 9 people were murdered by Dylan Roof. So we're going to be talking about that. My guest around about 8:20, 8:25 will be Mr. Lou Turner, who is a historian and who will help us contextualize these things, what it really means as we are going forward, what we should be doing about them, how we should be looking out for ourselves and protecting ourselves. There's a ton of conversation and opinions and thoughts that people have. The phone lines will be open for you at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. Hopefully you are waking this morning with a nice glass of water before you do anything, and then get you some get whatever you need to get yourself going. I want to say to the Muslim community, Ramadan Mubarak, and hopefully that you are having a successful Ramadan. And I also want to, again, encourage you all to call down here at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. You can call your loved ones up in Alabama, Decatur, Alabama, Tupelo, Mississippi, Nashville, Tennessee, Chicago, Illinois, wherever they may be, and tell them to, hey, you should tune in, check out Higher Ground at www.weft.org and click on listen live so we can they can join this conversation via telephone or over the internet listening in, and they can also call in at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. There's a couple of things going on here. Hopefully you will also hear from your state representative, who will be calling in for Carol's Corner at some point, so you'll hear a little bit about what's going on with this budget and how it may or may not impact us. But we also we definitely want you to hear from her as well. Let's see what else we got going on. So I'm going to read a couple of announcements, things that are taking place that you might want to you might want to partake in. So I'm going to get that stuff squared away here. I'm going to give you one more song, and then I'll be right back with you.
Office 365 is the office you know and love.
That's not
on the devices you use most.
Life is really skies. Take away everything and make everybody breathe high. But if you know what life is worth, you will look for yours on your earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand up for your rights.
Sick and tired of your ism, schism, game, dine and go to heaven in the Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light,
what you
gonna we gonna do? Stand up for
yeah,
our
rights, yeah,
so
yeah.
You better get
up, stand up
in the morning,
give it up,
stand up for your rights.
All right, all right. We are back. Thanking the great Mr. Bob Marley. Get up and stand up for your rights. You're going to have to bring heaven right here on earth, but you're going to have to create it. And so you're going to have to take a position, take a stand, and be a part of the solution to whatever concerns that you might have. But you're going to have to take a stand. You're definitely going to have to take a stand. So listen, we're going to do a couple of announcements here. This summer, there's a course, a teaching. It's called Teaching Ferguson. Teaching Ferguson. And I think it's quite timely, of course, with us having this conversation this morning about South Carolina as we talk about the value and the devaluing of black life. Teaching Ferguson, Professor Ken Salo, lecturer and public engagement coordinator, Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Illinois, June 26th, 29th, 30th, and July 1st of this year, 2015, from 1 to 5 p.m. In the Mellon Boardroom. 16 hours of and one board credit is what you will receive if you attend this course. In this course, teachers will explore cities as a resource for teaching social justice. Specifically, we explore how racially segregated urban spaces shape violent encounters between black youth and the white police, such as the recent tragedy in Ferguson, Missouri. We will read about cities and urban planning to understand how living in segregated neighborhoods that some call American apartheid produces urban violence. We will also talk and walk with residents of marginalized neighborhoods virtually and in person to understand the everyday urban experiences of exclusion and oppression that may seem invisible to the white populations, but are significant in the experience of the black youth and their families. These stories can provide Unit 4 district teachers with a pedagogy to connect personal narratives to the existing urban tensions and allow reflection and discussion with students on the ways in which we can overcome these histories of division and domination. One significant strategy would be to advocate for developing inclusive cities, for example, through mixed use and inclusive urban plans and policies. Our field expeditions will include 2 to 3 resident-led walking tours of Champaign-Urbana and possibly Ferguson, Missouri. So for more information and course registration, go to www.champaignschools.org/BCC. Again, that's www.champaignschools.org/BCC. This is a course that's being taught by Professor Ken Salo from the university, a good brother whom we know quite well, and you will definitely learn something. So this is a great opportunity for teachers who are of goodwill who really want to try to understand the mindset or the plight of urban youth and how to sort of bridge this gap that obviously exists. And you also get 16 hours and you get one board credit. So I think this was going to be pretty interesting. Hopefully I'll have Ken on to talk about this at some point. But this is June 26th, 29th, 30th and July 1st of this year from 1 to 5. It's 4 hours at a time at the Mellon Boardroom. So make sure you go sign up champagneschools.org/BCC. Of course, Juneteenth celebration. So happy Juneteenth, which was yesterday. But the celebration is today. Juneteenth celebration is today at the Douglas Center from 12 to 3. Now, I know many of you out there may not have any idea what Juneteenth is. Just sort of in summation as a quick summary so that you have an idea of what it is. Juneteenth is basically celebrated by African Americans because Emancipation Proclamation, or the notice that African people living in America had been freed, did not come to everyone at the same time. Of course, we live in this age of the internet and cell phones and all that kind of stuff, and we just automatically think information travels in nanoseconds. But the people in Galveston, Texas, for instance, did not get the information, did not get the memo or the Emancipation Proclamation freedom papers, if you will, until I believe it was 2 years after it had actually occurred. And they received it on June 19th. And so it's celebrated as Juneteenth. And it is the time in which many African Americans, folks who are born, Africans born in America, who are descendants of slaves here, of African people who were put in slavery here, celebrate their independence or their emancipation, if you will. So there's a lot of interesting information and history around Juneteenth. I believe Miss Amira Davis will be at Douglas Center today doing something there. And there's a lot going on. So I'm just encouraging you, 12 to 3, come by Douglas Center, sit down with the individuals who may have the more in-depth history on Juneteenth and see and celebrate some of the cultural aspects of African people and our and African Americans, how we get down. So I want you all to come out. If you're interested, you want to learn, you just want to participate. And it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. There's a whole bunch of black folks that don't know exactly what Juneteenth is either. So just come on out and be a part of this celebration from 12 to 3 today at Douglas Center. My guest who's coming on here in a little bit, Lou Turner, may be able to give us a little more insight into the history of Juneteenth as well. Also, there's been a lot of work going into the There's a lot of work being done by. Oh, yes. And State Representative Carol Ammons will also be in the House for those of you who want to talk to her about the about what's going on in Springfield. She will also be at the park from 12 to 3. So if you can, you want to corner her and give her a piece of your mind about something, you can do that. And she also can talk a little bit about that Juneteenth history. There's a lot of work going on by the group called First Followers, a new organization called First Followers that is primarily being run by Marlon Mitchell and Brother James. And they are having a program today on job readiness. Now, this is very, very critical for us, especially for people who are formerly incarcerated, who have come home and they're trying to get reacclimated and reintroduce themselves to the society that they have been away from for a while. And job readiness is something that we far too often take for granted. Many of us who have been in the workforce for a long time and work in what might be considered, quote unquote, a professional atmosphere or something like that. Job readiness is something that is being taken for granted. Just basic things that the person who has been involved in human resources or hiring people and firing people or involved in gainful employment for a long time, we begin to take these things for granted, that you should, how you should carry yourself in an interview, how you should fill out your application, what is the proper work ethic, what things should you stay away from, what's appropriate conversation in the workplace, what is the importance of punctuality, how do you sell yourself, so to speak. These things are extremely important, and the first followers, Brother Marlon and James, recognize the importance of this. And first followers is a group of individuals who are formerly incarcerated themselves, who understand the stigma of a felony conviction, and they have been working diligently. I think it's every Tuesday and Thursday they have an open forum for people to come in to Bethel AME Church, of all places, Bethel AME Church here locally, as we will be discussing the situation in South Carolina, the murders that took place in South Carolina inside Bethel AME Church there. This program is housed in the Bethel AME Church here. And so there's a long history around that. Certainly not trying to scare anybody from going down there, because we can't allow this sort of cowardice and heinous activity to stop us from being who we are. But please check out the first followers. I'm hoping that James or Marlon will call in and give me the direct information as far as the time that they're going to be there, and what time the program is going to be going on today. So I will hear from them shortly, and I'll give you guys the exact times. But it will be at Bethel AME Church on the corner of 4th and Park Street. And it is today. And this is an opportunity for you to come in and just get some of these basic soft skills on how to present yourself and how to be ready for the job that you're looking for, or for an appointment or a job that may be awaiting you. Now, this was very important because we recently had myself and several members of the Breakfast Club, along with the University of Illinois, and probably about 10 or 12 of the building trades, had a very very good first meeting about diversity in the trades, about how these environments where it's mostly white men have dominated the building trades, your carpenters, laborers, plumbers, pipe fitters, electricians, those things. That's what I'm talking about when I say building trades, where the individuals are building buildings and putting together, building streets, laying pavement, whatever it is that we need done from a structural standpoint. That's what I mean when I talk about your building trades. And they have been historically, if not 100% white men, upper 90s and lower 90s of white males who dominate the building trades. And it is a very, very positive profession to be in. Makes very good money. We're talking $25, $30, $35, $40 an hour, depending on which trade that you're in. And it's a career. And so we have a history, I guess, from the African-American perspective, of not being welcome there. And so we're working on that. And so we are calling them to the table, and they're coming willingly to come and share their past and what they're willing to do to make changes, to open up that opportunity, to make it a more welcoming environment. And also we want to show what it takes to get into the trades. So this is something that we're working on, and job readiness is exactly the point that we were working on. So I have a call. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, Brother Adub.
Good morning, sister. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Carol.
This is who?
Sister Carol.
Sister Carol. Hey, what's going on, Sister Carol? How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. You got your early morning voice on, and I'm already charged up, so you got to meet me. You got to come on.
I'm sore. I'm sore from playing basketball, so my fingers, everything.
Your jaws sore? Did you get hit in the jaw or something? I don't know. What your feet
everything.
Got to do with you talking?
mm-hmm.
No, we had a good time yesterday. We went to the gym and played a little basketball, a little two-on-two. Me and Carol was on the same team, and I threw a behind-the-back pass, and she caught it and dunked on this girl. It was amazing, y'all.
Mm-hmm. not quite a dunk, but it did go in. I'm listening in. I know that a lot of things are going on right now in the community, and I think you pretty much have all of today covered. So I think towards the end of the program, if I could call back in and update people on some events that we have coming up for the state office. Both myself and Senator Bennett will be hosting a few events this month that people really want to know about. So if I could, I'd like to get all of those together and call back in towards the end of the hour.
Okay. You're more than welcome to do so. I'm trying to get this thing turned off. Okay, there we go. All right.
But in the meantime, if people want to come out to Douglas Park today, we will have a table there. I'll be there from 12 to 3 and would love to talk to people individually about what's going on in Springfield. The budget talks that are right now stalled, to some degree stalled, but there's still some negotiation going on between the governor and the General Assembly. As people have been watching TV, the governor is campaigning and running commercials suggesting that the General Assembly is not working with him, not negotiating in good faith, just want to spend money, raise taxes. Those are all, you know, campaign tactics. But the reality is that the governor wants us to cut out essential services that he considers to be non-essential. Essential services that middle-class families and poor families in our community depend on. Many of those include things like transportation, the MTD. They want to slash the MTD budget. That would really, really impact this community. They want to slash the budget for Amtrak service for students who ride that and families who come to see their children at the university. That would impact that line item. They want to take and suspend the LIHEAP program. For those who don't know what LIHEAP is, it is the energy assistance program for people who are working but cannot meet the obligation of continually rising energy costs. They want to take all of the money out of that line item, and they want to suspend the service. They want to cut Medicaid by $108 million, which impacts low-income families primarily and those with limited insurance available to them. The Medicaid cuts would really devastate seniors and children mostly. They want us to agree to do that in their proposed budget. And so some of the things that are being put on the table as items that are considered that need to be cut to balance the budget are things that families in this community cannot live without. And so it is a very, yes, it's a very difficult decision to make. There are cuts in the proposed budget already that the General Assembly put towards Medicaid and other services, but not to the degree that the governor wants them cut. And so that is what's keeping us from being able to actually finally pass this budget. Now, we did pass a budget to the governor. He has our budget. And he can line item veto that budget. He can veto the entire budget. But at this point, he hasn't decided to do anything other than running commercials and press releases.
Okay. So I know a lot of people are very concerned about that because, you know, on the ground we have, whether it's daycare, how are daycares affected by this?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How are daycares affected by this?
Well, daycare providers, part of his proposal was to change the rates and to cut the program by eliminating child care for anyone over 5 years old. So there would be no child care for children that are six and up. And the rate would change for daycare providers, which is already a low rate. The per day rate would change. And so that program, many of those providers would not be paid what they should be paid, A, and then B, they wouldn't be able to care for a family member that has a child that's five and a child that is six. One of those children couldn't go to daycare. He also wants to, as of July 1st, he intends at this point to allow the government to shut down. When we say that, that simply means that he refuses to sign the budget that is being, that has been sent over to him from the General Assembly, or he refuses to take action on that budget, cutting it, changing it. He can do whatever he wants once the General Assembly passes it to him. But he is dead set on allowing services to stop in our state. I was told Tuesday that the governor's office has been sending letters out to providers in certain areas of the state, meaning providers of services, period, all services, that they would no longer be paid if come July 1. So it is a good sign that he intends to allow the government to be shut down.
Mm-hmm. And that is solely his choice.
That is solely his choice. The General Assembly's responsibility is to send him a budget. We sent him a spending plan that he could make changes to as he has the authority to. He has not decided to do that part yet. And he has all of the authority. We are to give him a spending authority, and that is our job to do that. And he has decided not to do anything with that at this point.
Okay. Well, we definitely want to stay abreast of what's happening there. We appreciate you. You know, I know it's hard for you to get on this show. You got to go through so many hoops to break through this show to get in, you know, because, you know, if I don't like you, you ain't getting on my show. Right. You know what I mean? So you've done a good job with this constituent. But look, we definitely want to stay in tune. I really want to give our guest as much time as possible. We want the community and whoever's listening, wherever, to really have an opportunity to engage in this conversation that we're going to have about the murders that took place in South Carolina. But we're going to offer a context to that. I'm just going to sort of sit back and throw a few questions at Mr. Lou Turner here, who is more than capable of giving us a historical context as well as what does this mean going forward. And I hope that you all will stay engaged and that you will keep listening. And I know that you were at the prayer vigil yesterday held by Pastor Larry Lewis and the members of Bethel AME Church here locally. Did you want to talk about that a little bit as we segue into that?
Yeah. Well, we there was a quick call out to people at for noon yesterday. Pastor Larry Lewis, whose church is a member of the AME church affiliation, that Mother Emanuel, where the shooting took place, they're all a part of the same church organization. And Pastor Lewis just brought people together to just really, pray for those victims, pray for their families, and for us to understand that we need to certainly pray for each other in this community, because that's just a sign of things to come. And it was a full turnout. People did get the message, and people came, and it was really a good moment to stop and acknowledge that something tragic had happened that we all need to be aware of. So I'll sit back and listen to Dr. Lou Turner. Good morning to you. I will listen and hopefully get guidance through this conversation, like all of us really need at this time.
All right. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you all.
Okay. So listen, you all, if you want to join this conversation, phone number is 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. No matter where you are, all you have to do is dial that number and you can chime in. And you can listen to us live at www.weft.org. Click on Listen Live and you can follow us there, and then give us a call at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. In the studio with me this morning is a good brother. I've known him for a little while. You know, he doesn't like all the fancy titles and stuff. He's a pretty laid back dude. Don't text him. He's not going to respond. You're going to have to call him. He's old school. But he has a wealth of knowledge, tremendous historian, and just some personal experiences that add to that. And he is here to share with us his thoughts about various different things. But in particular, our focus this morning is South Carolina. Of course, our condolences go out to the families in South Carolina, the church family there, and everyone who's grieving and who's hurt by this tragedy. So please Talk to us, Lou. Tell us a little bit about yourself and let's get into it.
Well, my name is Lou Turner. I'm the academic advisor and curriculum coordinator for the Department of African American Studies at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I've taught African American studies for many years, various areas in sociology, including criminology, race and ethnic relations, social public policy, social theory, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, African American and African history. So, interestingly enough, I had actually sent you and several other people earlier this week a piece that I did on Denmark Vesey.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the church, Emmanuel AME, came out of that very important event in 1822 in Charleston.
Lou, do me a favor. Try to bring your mic a little bit closer, or just slide a little bit closer to it there. There we go.
Okay.
There we go. Oh, yeah. There we go.
Okay. There's been a lot of talk about the historical nature of the church of mm-hmm. Emmanuel AME, and it took a day or so for it to rise to the top of what made it historical.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, it wasn't until the second day that at least I heard, there may have been other people said it earlier, that I finally heard the connection to Denmark Vesey. Denmark Vesey was the organizer and leader of the most ambitious and most comprehensive slave rebellion in American history. It involved upwards to 9,000 people before it was ultimately betrayed and exposed. But many things in American history right up to today stem from the Denmark Vesey rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did the church come out of that, and that's an interesting story in itself, which raises a very interesting point or question in my mind about why this psychopathic young white supremacist would drive as far as he did from his home, which is not in the neighborhood, to this particular church.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the churches, black churches, he could have gone to in Charleston.
Yes, indeed.
There was one brother who was a state representative who said he lived right down the street from this racist family. And so he raised the question. He says, why would he, and he said, it's a drive to get from where he lived to Emmanuel. So it begs the question of not just what was in his mind from the point of view of white supremacy, but what may have been in his mind in terms of any knowledge of African-American liberation history and mm-hmm. theology. And Emmanuel does represent one of the important moments in the development of what others like James Cone call black liberation theology.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, that's one of the things that I think gets lost as well in this. Anyway, Denmark Vesey, I think, gives you some important context for understanding the significance of Emmanuel. Denmark Vesey was bought his freedom from his slave master, Joseph Vesey, who was a slave trader and a slave broker in Charleston, when Denmark Vesey literally won the lottery, won $1,500 lottery, the East Bay Lottery in Charleston, and bought his freedom for $600. He was a master carpenter. He was a skilled worker and started his own business as a freedman, and lived at 56 Bull Street in Charleston. And it's now a historical monument, although it's not open to the public, but it's on the National Park Registry. There are several reasons which launched Denmark Vesey into the attempt to organize the insurrection. One was the Haitian Revolution that he was inspired by. Secondly was the politics in the United States at the time around the compromise around Missouri, whether mm-hmm. Missouri was going to enter the Union as a free state or not. And he was very much involved in that discussion. Secondly, his children, he was married to slave women, and his children nevertheless were born into slavery. So while he was a free man, as we know, the disposition of the children is determined by the disposition of the mother. And so if the mother is a slave, then the children, even if the father is a free man, is the children are born are slave. And the slave master of the woman can determine the visitation of the father. So that was obviously one of the reasons that was pushing him. Probably a fourth reason is that Denmark Vesey was a Methodist, and the white Methodists had excommunicated him and about 500 other black Methodists from the Methodist Church in Charleston, which then led to them creating the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Emmanuel. Now, there had already been the AME established, I believe, in Baltimore. That's why I think the Emmanuel is like the third oldest black church in the country. So the African Methodist movement was already underway by a few years when they decided to affiliate with it. So Emmanuel comes out of the creation. This is even before the rebellion that Denmark Vesey led. Emmanuel was established as a denomination, a black denomination for black Charleston Christian community. Again, even before the rebellion. The rebellion itself is very, very significant. It's perhaps no exaggeration to say that the Denmark Vesey rebellion is one of the major moments which leads to the Civil War. It created a constitutional crisis because of the rebellion. South Carolina, which was the seat of the Confederacy, passed what were called the Nullification Acts, which is essentially states' rights. They felt that they didn't have to follow state laws. They could nullify any state law that they chose on the basis of states' rights. And the first federal law that they nullified, or that came under nullification, was the Negro Seamen's Act. There was always the suspicion, and it's more than a suspicion, and particularly after the rebellion, that because Charleston is a seaport town, that Negro seamen who work on the boats, black seamen who worked on the boats, would bring in from the North or from the Caribbean news of black freedom and whatnot. And so
The Haitian Revolution.
Like the Haitian Revolution. So they would, the state of South Carolina sought to prohibit black seamen from coming into the port. And this went against federal law, most important clause in the Constitution is, of course, interstate commerce. It's the Commerce Clause.
So can we just pause for a second there? Because I don't want... I heard something that I thought was very profound. I thought needed to be sort of delved into just for a brief moment, a little bit further. So a nullification is put forth by the state of South Carolina to stop black men, black seamen, from coming into the port because they were concerned about them bringing information?
Right. Exactly.
Information.
And there was reason to do that, to think about that. In 1829, all these things get connected. David Walker's appeal is written. David Walker was a follower of Denmark Vesey. And Mariah Stewart was a protege of David Walker. And so David Walker's appeal would, one of the plays in which the appeal was communicated was through seamen. Black seamen. So there was reason to believe that this was the case. But anyway, the South Carolina passed this Negro Seamen's Act in 1823, the year after the Denmark Vesey thing, and it created a constitutional crisis because the federal government said, you know, you're in violation of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. This begins the constitutional crisis, which leads over the next several decades to the Civil War. So when they talk about the Civil War, from at least Lincoln's point of view initially, being a constitutional crisis.
It's this the Commerce.
It's the Nullification Acts mm-hmm. that the South Carolina legislature passed. Also, in response to the Denmark VC Rebellion, South Carolina felt that it would create its own military academy to protect itself. It felt it would no longer look to the federal government to do so. They felt exposed by this rebellion, so they created one of the most famous military schools in the country, the Citadel, which mm-hmm. was created in response to the Denmark VC rebellion. Probably lastly, because I don't want to talk too long on this, lastly, the rebellion is exposed, and the exposure brings up very serious questions about contradictions within the African-American community itself. Hmm. Denmark Vesey had begun to organize the rebellion in 1818. The rebellion happens in 1822. So for 4 years, this is a free man with his own resources. He's organizing slaves both in the countryside and in the city. There's urban slavery, which we don't often pay enough attention to. Mm-hmm. And the rebellion was so successfully organized that the two major slaves of the governor of South Carolina, Ned and Rolla Bennett, were two of Denmark Vesey's closest lieutenants. Hmm. That's how far up into the government the conspiracy had gone. Hmm. A young man by the name of William Wilson is on a dock in Charleston one night, about a month or so before the rebellion was supposed to happen. The rebellion is scheduled to occur on July 14th. Interestingly enough, it's the Bastille Day of the French Revolution. And this young man is talking to this other black man who is a mulatto, which is important, who is a slave himself. And he says, this young man who thinks, well, this is another black man, he says, hey, do you know, essentially saying, do you know what's about to happen? Big things are about to happen. And he tells this guy by the name of Prelo that this rebellion is going to happen. Denmark Vesey had organized the rebellion so tightly that no one knew everything about it. Everybody just knew a small part of the mm-hmm. of the plan. Moreover, it was organized according to ethnic groups because Charleston was a very cosmopolitan city, a black cosmopolitan city. You could hear African dialects spoken in Charleston in the 1820s because fresh slaves were constantly coming in.
Right.
You could hear European languages, Asian languages, African languages spoken. And so he organized these black people in terms of their African ethnic identity. He himself was Ghanaian. Gullah Jack, who was an African medicine man, organized the Angola unit. Others organized other units from Africa, as well as Christian units, a French-speaking unit. They had various units that it was organized. And this thing was tight, very tight. And this is just in the city. We're not even talking about the countryside, where the mass of slaves would be coming in mm-hmm. Down the river. So this man, Prelo, was told this, and he was beside himself. And so he goes to a man by the name of William Pencil, who was a free black man, who belonged to something called the Brown Society, which is a mulatto society. 72% of the free black population of Charleston owned slaves themselves. Mm-hmm. I talked about the contradictions. Now, mm-hmm. part of that was due to the fact that black people who were free bought their relatives back from slavery, but South Carolina law forbid them to free them. So a large group of them were relatives.
Not really doing slave work type of thing.
But there was still a large group of them
that were like
Pencil, this guy that this guy Prelo went to, and Prelo, remember, is a slave, was one of those. He was trying to be a white man, white slave owner. Mm-hmm. He had black slaves. And Pencil told Prelo to go to his master and tell him about it. He does so. His master then alerts the authorities, and they go and interrogate this young man who had told Prelo the issue in the first place. This young man doesn't know the whole plan because of the way Denmark VC had organized it. So they said, okay. And so then it leads to them interrogating two other people, Mingo Harth and Peter Poyas. Peter Poyas is the real hero of the Denmark VC rebellion. Mm-hmm. These brothers come in, they're interrogated, and they are so cool and composed. They say, we don't know what you're talking about. And of course, nobody knows everything. And right. so, although they are close lieutenants of Denmark VC, and they do know everything. And so there's nothing. They could find no evidence, any culpability that these people had for the rebellion. But they still didn't trust them, so they had them surveilled. They had them followed. Mm-hmm. Still could not find out anything. It was so tight. So he took the next step, third step. The third step was to find a black man who was desperate to free his family, a man by the name of William Bartlett. He was desperate to free his family, and the white authority says, if you become an informant for us, if you infiltrate, we will free you and free your family. They freed him in order to be to infiltrate. Never did free his family, by the way. So it was him who infiltrated into the conspiracy and began identifying people, and that's what broke it up. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, a thing came to light. A bunch of people are rounded up, including Denmark VC. They find Denmark VC in a warehouse on the wharf waiting for a ship to Haiti. That's where he gets arrested. So he's on his way to Dessalines, Haiti. And his trial goes on for a week. It's behind closed doors. And ultimately, him and his lieutenants are executed. While they're waiting for their execution, Peter Poyas tells them all. He says, die silent like me. Do not expose anybody. He says, if we're willing to risk our lives to free people, we have to be willing to risk our lives to save them as well. And that became the motto of the thing. Poyas had also given them the motto for organizing. And his motto was this: do not trust that class of men, meaning black men, who get their clothes handed down from their masters.
Do not trust them.
That class of men. And of course, this guy Prelo was one of those men.
Mm-hmm.
And so this poor young black man who trusted him because he was a brother,
mm-hmm.
he didn't follow that motto. Mm-hmm. And so it's... Poyas kind of gives you the kind of organizational principles of what the rebellion was mm-hmm. about.
Peter Poyas.
P-O-Y-A-S. Anyway, there's a trial. There's about 130 people because Poyas and others, the people under them, they never exposed them. So a lot of people made it through.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy by the name of, well, Mingo Harth. No, William Gell was one of the lieutenants. He flipped. He was the only one of the lieutenants who flipped because some of his people were getting frantic and stuff. So he mm-hmm. flipped. And so there, his people got arrested because mm-hmm. he flipped on everybody. Snitched.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the people who essentially got arrested. He was deported, mm-hmm. whatnot. As a sign of terror, and this is what connects to today, the state of South Carolina on one day decided to send a message to the black community by hanging 20 men on a place called The Lines. It's at the corner of King and Calhoun Street. It's called The Lines. And it was a display, and it's a spectacle of hanging 20 black men. And there may have been, I think, one woman as well involved in that, that was hung. And their bodies were left to hang out for 3 days for public exposure. After they were hung, their families could not claim their bodies. They were given to surgeons for dissection as cadavers. Mm. One guy, it was an interesting story about his execution. One of the 20 when the mechanism of the scaffold didn't work and it looked like his feet were going to touch the ground, he wasn't going to be hung, he held his feet up and hung, let himself be hung in defiance. And so you get these stories. One last caveat. At the end of my article, I mentioned this, and we know we get into these kind of silos of our history. We think of one thing about a person, and we don't see that things are much more complex. Dr. King would often cite in his speech, he cited it at the March on Washington, he cited it many, many times, a poem by James Russell Lowell. The James Russell Lowell poem, and or the passages from James Russell Lowell poem, goes like this. Right forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future. And James Russell Lowell wrote it in response to the execution of John Brown in 1859, leading a rebellion. Mm-hmm. John Brown's rebellion was inspired by Denmark Vesey's.
Right.
And the scaffolding, that right forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, is a reference to that day on the lines in South Carolina when 20 black people were hung. And so the idea of terrorizing the black community by either state-sponsored terrorism or by lone wolf terrorism.
Or some organizational structure.
Or some all of these kinds of things have a history that go back to the creation of Emmanuel AME Church.
With the intent to terrorize.
Terrorize.
So, okay, so that is what you call contexting. even Lou had to take a drink after that. But that's what I love about being able to sit down and with you and Sundiata and Ken and some of the other professors who are so thorough in your understanding of history to paint a picture or to educate and inform us, inform me, because others may know everything that you just said. I doubt it, but I think it's some other people who have a little more information than I do. So I'm always thoroughly informed when you're able to just sort of get that out, right? You know, because it doesn't happen like that all the time. But it's a very clear picture of Denmark Vesey. It reminds me of how someone like a Marcus Garvey, who inspires Malcolm's dad, who inspires Malcolm, who inspires Elijah, doesn't really get... You know, you just sort of forget about how they inspired other people and what you said about Denmark Vesey and how he was inspired by the Haitian Revolution and how he inspired other people like David Walker and so on. And then the AME Church being formed by, and this is the component that's really profound to me and allows me to connect dots even all the way back to even what the Nation of Islam and Elijah was saying about do for self. What you just said was that Denmark, one, he bought his freedom and he was a master carpenter. We're talking about all his trades, opportunities in building trades now where African Americans and black folks have been sort of locked out of the building trades when we were the master builders and tradesmen and skillsmen from the beginning. And then was organizationally and structurally locked out of that. And we're having that conversation today. But then he used his own resources to organize the rebellion. So he was able to be a sort of a businessman to create his own. So he was not tied to the power structure or whatever. But it just really showed that, and even the AME Church was that you don't want me to be a part of your white Methodist. I'll go start my own stuff. I do not have to be my identity or my success does not have to be tied to you. If you don't want me to be a part of that, I'm not going to beg and grovel and to get into be to assimilate into what you're doing. I can go start my own thing. And here it is. We have a Bethel AME Church here in our city and all over the country. And it stems from the
Black liberation theology.
Right. And I have been talking. I've been listening to James Cone and, of course, the controversial Jeremiah Wright, right? You know, but understanding black liberation theology is another component that's very important to this. And like you said, it's so much more complex than, you know, I have a dream or by any means. We get, just put into these sound bites and you get one little thing about a person's history and you think you know everything about them.
Aaron, even Barack, when he referenced the history of the church having to do with black liberation, he said words came out of his mouth. That's what he was talking about. He couldn't go there. Then he talked about the civil rights, because the church was later burned down. They had to recreate it, rebuild it again, whatnot. But he knew the history. I mean, he knows the history.
He absolutely knows that. Right. Yeah, so. So listen, y'all, it's the top of the hour, 9 o'clock. You're listening to WEFT Higher Ground. I'm your host, Brother Aaron Ammons. In studio with me is none other than Dr. Lou Turner, giving us a breakdown, a history lesson on the Denmark Vesey's involvement and the history of the AME Church in South Carolina, some of the history of the terror imposed on black people in the state of South Carolina, to which extent they would go to nullify certain aspects of the federal of the U.S. Constitution to maintain their ability to keep slavery alive or to protect their interests there. We learned a little bit about the Citadel, the military academy that was formed in South Carolina in response to the rebellion of Denmark Vesey and that organized rebellion. So it's the top of the hour, 9 o'clock. We definitely want you to participate in the conversation if you so choose. Phone number down here is 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. If you have a question, a comment, whatever it is that you would like to say, you can get involved in the conversation. You can pose it to me or Dr. Lou. We are here and ready to answer your question or to hear your statement. 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. So, Lou, now let's talk a little bit then about, and what I really, really like about what you've done is that you made me think about the opportunity we have now to talk about the history, the importance of black liberation theology, the importance of even the skill of being a master carpenter allowed him the opportunity to have the resources and his own business, right, so that he could sort of be free from not just that chattel sort of slavery, but also being tied to having his purse strings pulled by the dominant culture or the slave masters. Go ahead, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Aaron. Hi, it's Sandra Otten. How are you?
Hey, Sandra, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really enjoying the history lesson this morning and really appreciate you taking the time to bring your guest in and for his wisdom that he's sharing. And I wondered if he has recommended reading for a lay person to just be able to get the background that he's providing. And if he would share that with us.
Okay, will do. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the first place I'd go to is there's an encyclopedia. This is a reference book you can only get in your library. You can't take it out. It's edited by the famous archivist from Fisk University, Jessie Carney Smith. She had a two-volume series, Notable Black American Men, and the second volume is Notable Black American Women. I wrote the encyclopedia entry for Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner, like letting the fox in the hen house. I would begin there, and I have a pretty extensive bibliography. A lot of Denmark Vesey, one of the things you'll find out is famous black abolitionist Archibald Grimke gave a very important lecture at the American Negro Academy at the turn of the century, 20th century, on Denmark Vesey, called The Martyrs of 1822. In fact, the title of his lecture is On the Scaffold or something like that, and The Martyrs of 1822. So Archibald Grimke is one of the people. John Killens wrote on it. John Killens has written on it. There's a number of people in the black intellectual tradition who have written on Denmark Vesey. I think there's a recent book on Denmark Vesey. Which contains some of the information from the trial transcript, because they were one of the things you're talking about, the issue of skilled labor. Denmark Vesey had all these brothers who were his lieutenants. These were all skilled workers of one mm-hmm. kind or another, even up into the governor's mansion. That really kills me. And many of them knew how to write. And so there were records that they kept, lists mm-hmm. and plans that ended up they burned because they were discovered, when they were discovered.
Okay.
And so the only thing we have is the notes or the papers from the two magistrates who tried them. That's where most of our information mm-hmm. comes from. So, but there's a lot. There are a number of books out on Denmark VC.
So, if you think of any others too during this conversation, just sure. drop them and we can announce them. Good morning. You on the air?
Hi. It's been a shattering week, it seems to me. This is Paul. I should be working on my show, but this is really a good radio. You mentioned somebody being Guyanese, and it made me think of
Denmark VC.
He was.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So, and this black sailor law mm-hmm. makes me think of the ferment that was going on in through the Caribbean and the British Crown. Rebellions that were happening there, and so it was sort of all of a piece, it seems. And it also makes me think of the rather controversial Gerald Horn and some of his theories about what really happened. I mean, he goes as far as saying the American Revolution was mainly motivated by the fact that the British were moving towards a new kind of dominion, not necessarily getting rid of slavery per se, but because they couldn't handle all the rebellions, they just it was a bad proposition business wise or something. It's sort of his thesis, and he thinks that the American Revolution was based basically against severing from Britain because we still wanted to run the slave trade. Even the Bostonians were making lots of money on it. So that's too much for Saturday morning, it seems like. But I thought I'd throw it out there. But I wanted to see if you could say some more about the basis of, and he was enslaved from Guyana. He was a Guyanese slave, and he was brought up to South Carolina. Or?
No, it's very interesting. He Joseph Vesey, from whom he gets his name, was a Bermuda slave trader. He originally came out of Bermuda, but he ran slaves from what we now call Haiti to South Carolina. He later retires and becomes a slave broker. He becomes an insurer of slave cargo. By the way, some of our major corporations got their beginnings like that. Mm. If you look at Aetna Insurance began as an insurer of slave cargo for the domestic slave trade. There was the international insurers, and VC was one of these brokers who would insure slave cargo. Lehman Brothers, by the way, was one, which went out of business during the 2008, had a role in that too. But the point is that actually Joseph Vesey buys Denmark Vesey on the island of St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. The interesting thing is this: the Virgin Islands is owned by Denmark. Denmark was in the slave trade big time. And a lot of people don't know this. Mm. Thus the name Denmark Vesey. And so he came from St. Thomas. The reason, the connection to Guinea in Africa, this is the Guinea I'm talking about, is that most of the slaves in the Virgin Islands came from Guinea.
Oh, okay.
There's Michael Gomez does a whole lot on the various areas of Africa and the ethnic groups in Africa where slaves are taken and where they are located in the Caribbean and particularly in the Americas. Certain mm-hmm. slaves from groups come from certain areas, and white slave owners have this original predilection for slaves coming from particular parts of Africa, or mm-hmm. African captives, we should say. They're made slaves in the
right,
United States,
exactly.
but they're captives.
Right.
And whatnot. And so that's how we know that or suspect. We don't even know whether he was born in St. Thomas or born in Guinea, but we do know that since most of the slaves came from Guinea, who were in St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, that's the connection.
So, there's a couple of things that come out for me, and I guess since I'm hosting, I get to do this. there's a lot of talk around slave names, right? A lot of people talk about that. And I don't want to go off on that tangent, Carol. I'm not going there. I know she's... I'm just saying there's no clearer example than Denmark, VC, right? Because that's the slaveholder's name or slave owner's name or the captive owner's name. See, that's the other point, that we continue to sort of psychologically talk about African people who are human beings with cultures and societies and high knowledge and all kind of stuff, diminish everyone to a slave. Right. They were not slaves. They were made into slaves. Right. Exactly. Okay. Which is a very important point. I get in conversations with white people all the time. They don't quite get that. Not all white people, Sandra. I'm saying some, right? Most don't get the importance of small that things like those distinctions that are sort of microaggressions type of things that we feel very assaulted by in various forms. I don't like the word minority when it talks about, you know, groups of ethnic people, right? You know, so that's one component. But Denmark being so involved, now you have Denmark VC. But it also says that regardless of what you name me, if I have the right spirit in me, right, the rebellion, he organizes the rebellion because I don't have to take this. I don't have to live like this, you know. But that's a deeper, a more involved conversation. But I just
to your point, by the way, because another book came to mind, which is indispensable, and that's Sterling Stuckey's book. Sterling Stuckey's book begins, what is it, Slave Culture and the Development of Black Consciousness or something. He begins with the Denmark VC, and he's done, as a black scholar, more than anyone, I would say, in unpacking many of the things you just mentioned. His argument is that the creation of a black American identity, you can see it being created in the cauldron of the Denmark VC organizing the rebellion, because he brings all of these different African ethnic groups together. That's the thing to get about Charleston. Because Charleston, South Carolina, way up to right up to the end of the Civil War, was still bringing in Africans and whatnot, and so they were constantly getting these fresh captives from Africa who were very rebellious. They didn't accept this stuff, and so there was South Carolina was constantly roiling with rebellion. Denmark VC's is kind of the climax of a series of rebellions which go back to the 1780s. You know, and excuse me, 1760s. There were rebellions throughout throughout there. The Stono Rebellion is in South Carolina, right outside of Charleston. Stono River Rebellion. And so there was rebellions leading all the way up to Denmark VC's and whatnot. So South Carolina, far from being in any way passive, was roiling with rebellion from the 1740s, 1750s, 1760s, all the way up to 1822. So, and part of the reason is that they kept bringing in Africans.
Who was like, I ain't taking it.
Right, not taking it. So
here we are with a very thorough historical context leading up to and tying in the AME Church. So now today in 2015, we have a 21-year-old white male who goes into from what I understand and what I've gathered, predominantly, if not all, African-American church, and certainly African Methodist opinions, certainly for and created by, from the history that you've given us. Historic church. Emmanuel, Mother Emmanuel, right? And sits down with them for an hour in Bible study, then stands up and executes nine of them. And I'm so, it reminds me of the whole four little girls, the situation and the bombing. But this is at a different level, because setting a bomb in a place and going away and you don't know who you're going to kill, who's going to get. But to sit down and look in the eyes of these individuals for an hour and sort of break bread with them, and then execute them. It brings to mind, it makes me want to say that, okay, something's psychologically disturbed with this individual, but it's still, the act itself is still racist. It's terrorizing. It's terror. It's domestic terrorism, right? So now there's this conversation about whether or not it's terrorism
or hate crime.
What is it? What do you think about that?
It's domestic terrorism, and the federal government, they said everything is on the table. You know, they'll see what they come up with. Timothy McVeigh does it. They have no problem calling it terrorism. He had an agenda. He has his point of view, and he pushed it. So does this psychopath.
Right.
So it's domestic terrorism. There's state-sponsored terrorism in our history. I mean, the state of Mississippi was state-sponsored terrorism. I mean, the governor of Mississippi.
Right.
I mean, it was state-sponsored. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, civil rights workers, bodies floating down rivers and whatnot. I mean, this was sponsored by the state. Mm-hmm. So whether state-sponsored, whether it's lone wolf or whatever you want to call it, I mean, all of these categories that are alive today in our discourse, our global discourse mm-hmm. about what's happening, they apply here. And they, because of, I hate the term conversation of mm-hmm. About race, but because of the inability of this country to deal with the question, it's being pushed, you know, in this country's face that these are uncomfortable and inconvenient truths that have to be dealt with. And the truth is that white supremacy has always had a terroristic component mm-hmm. To it, whether it's cops who are doing it or whether it is, in this case, this lone wolf.
So we've had
a lone wolf.
So now there's this question around the objective. What is the objective for this this young man, this psychopath, this terrorist? What is he trying to do? Is it just kill a bunch of people, or is he sending a particular message, trying to do something bigger? Let's take this call. We'll come back to it. Go ahead, caller. You on the air?
Yeah, brother Ada, Ted Atkinson. How you doing?
All right, Ted. How are you?
Good program.
Thank you.
We know the guy wasn't a lone wolf. If he was a lone wolf, he'd have been out shooting wolves.
Yes, sir.
Your program is very good. I see that. Professor Turner is tying in this religious aspect of it, because I think that that's very important, because it seems like with all these rebellions that occur, it looks like there's always a divine component to it. Because prior to Denmark Vesey, if he can remember Gabriel Prosser,
right?
Yeah, back in the 1800s,
right.
You know, he felt like he was being called, you know, to deliver his people. So it had that kind of religious tone to it. It always seems like in all our what we call rebellions or protests or marches or songs, everything is coming out of the church. And then, of course, after Denmark Vesey, you can also look at Nat Turner.
Prophet.
He felt the same way, too. He felt like he was called by God to lead the children of Egypt, as they called it, out of bondage. So it looks like these revolts, these protests, these are things that I just think that we always had in mind, you know, to have freedom, because, you know, we came as a captured people. So these revolts were happening on the sea. They were happening on ships. They were happening, you know, all throughout the Middle Passage. So it's always a struggle, and it's been going on for a long time. But generally, the centerpiece is we generally use religion, comes out of religion, which, you know, is our house of worship. It's where we all come together to try to figure out as to how we should move forward, and still in trying to gaining our freedom. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy Brother Turner. It kind of takes me back a little bit, and I always like to hear a little bit about history.
You struck a chord with the local historian, Ted Atkinson. I don't know if you know Ted, mm-hmm. But Ted's been doing a lot of work around, you know, keeping us. Before we start really building the relationships that we've built with you and Sundiata and many of the other professors at the university, Ted was our go-to guy all the time, you know what I mean? Because that was about, you know, that was the only person I knew I had access to. And so Ted is on the radio sometimes. He used to be on a lot more on the other Saturdays that I alternate with Eunice Buckner Boone. So we should sit down and break bread and just sort of hang out a little bit.
I would take Ted's point further. I think he raises the critical point that ties back to the point you were talking about just before Ted came on.
Hey, thanks for calling, Ted. All right.
And that is that Emmanuel AME was the site of Black liberation theology. Insofar as we don't recognize that, somebody else will. And so Ted is right in the sense that he might not be a lone wolf in the sense that, believe me, in some quarters of this country, people are applauding him.
Yes.
You know, even if, you know, Fox don't know what to do with it, there are people who are. And so that's the way this stuff works, that it's, it be, creates this this kind of atmosphere. And so that we need to recognize, if we don't recognize it, then we kind of leave ourselves open that a church like this was part of our liberation, a very important part of our liberation. So I think that he raises a very, very...
Well, you know, I was trying to tie these things together, and this is where I just...
And by the way, to your point, you say, well, what was the purpose? The purpose is the same purpose as in July, whatever it was, 26th, 1822, when the state of South Carolina hung 20 black people on the lines. It's the same point. Okay. He said it. That young man said it. He says he wanted to start a race war. He wanted to send a message and to terror. And that's what, that's me.
Oh, okay.
And that's, and so it, I don't see that there is a tremendous amount of difference. I mean, okay. Who knows what he knew about this history?
So I like that. I like it from that standpoint, because I'm concerned on two fronts. One is that if we sort of take this bait, if you will, of trying to get into a race war, right? Where we have, we went all the way back to Trayvon Martin and this arming of the militia and who's walking around armed and practicing shooting. It ain't yeah, us,
right.
Okay, right? So that's not a good path for us to travel at this particular point, right?
Right.
So,
right.
And if ever, I mean, I'm not saying that it's ever a path for us to travel, but I'm saying that if something like that were to take place, you know, that would be us taking the bait for something that I think would be almost suicidal for us to go down that road. So those who may be thinking that that's what's going on, who want to respond in the like manner, you should be mindful of that, right? You know, that what I'm, I guess what I'm getting at is that I would be concerned about folks trying to retaliate in a way that leads to or further perpetuates this idea. If his objective or these skinheads or whoever's objective is to start a race war, right, that they feel that they are prepared for, right, and you're not. That's the point that I'm trying to make. And secondly, then if the point is to terrorize, right, then certainly if I choose to, in a war or in a battle, I strategically decide to target a particular area of yours, it's because it's an area of strength. When I play chess, I look for the person, I like to see which piece you like to move most. And then I try to either trade off or get rid of that piece. So what you're pointing to and what Ted's talking about is the church, obviously, is they see it, those in opposition, as a point of strength for us. Right. And in particular, the Bethel AME, the Mother Emmanuel, was targeted because it of its history of with Denmark VC and Black liberation theology. And so the point that I'm hearing you make is that for me, as I go to church, I don't hear Black liberation theology here. You know, I don't hear Black liberation theology. I don't hear James Cone. I don't hear our local pastors even understanding what Black liberation theology is and its roots and what it means to us as a people. So that's an opportunity out of this that I think arises now for us to be able to make those connections, that this was not some haphazard. He didn't drive over 200 miles or whatever to leave his home. He could have went to a 500 different black churches, you know what I'm saying, between that where he lived and where he went to in South Carolina. He chose this one very specifically, and we should ask ourselves why and understand why and see the strength that we could get from it.
Right.
So that's I'm putting it all together here. And that also from a layman's standpoint, and I love when I talk about when Brother Martell is like, listen, you know, this is what I see on the ground in the streets. And so then somebody like Sundiata, while we sit down at Breakfast Club, will say, yeah, that's, we connect that from an academic type of standpoint to a very grassroots on the ground standpoint. Mm-hmm. We connect that. We're really saying the same thing. You're seeing the manifestation of it, though, on the ground.
Right.
Well, when I ask, why didn't they want you to read the Bible? And for me, it's a very interesting conversation because, you know, on one hand, you see the Bible as a tool of enslavement. But then on the other hand, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, they say, no, I read Jesus as a revolutionary.
Right. The thing to catch, one of the main points to catch about Black liberation theology and about the Black use of the Bible is that which book?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Many of the people back during slavery read the Old Testament more than they read the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in the songs, Exodus, let my people go. That's all. And that ain't turn the other cheek.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Right.
In other words, they were all Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really reading the Bible from the Old Testament.
Eye for an eye.
Eye for an eye. I mean, and so it's important to understand which part that they that they're reading. Yeah. There's politics to the Bible. I mean, it's
right.
You know, and how
right.
and how it's interpreted. That's all it is. It's all about interpretation. Anyway,
yeah.
So.
Oh, but that's a very key point.
By the way, let me tell you about I get your point about armed. Story about Martin Luther King meeting Bayard Rustin for the first time. Martin Luther King's house had gotten bombed. Bayard Rustin's traveling down from the north undercover. He's in the trunk of a car to try to sneak in and whatnot. Mm-hmm. He comes to Martin Luther King's house in Montgomery. He comes up on the porch. It's dead of night. And he sees all these brothers with guns and whatnot. He said, well, the first thing you got to do, Doc, is get rid of all these guns. Because it was Bayard Rustin who was committed to nonviolence and mm-hmm. Gandhi and nonviolence before King.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, and the thing was, it was for defense.
Right.
I heard a brother yesterday who was a pastor who was like really, really upset talking about Charleston. And he says, what is, you know, Obama, what is the president doing? What is he doing? He said, we have to defend our church. So the woman, you know, now, so what are you talking about? Arms? No, I'm not talking about bringing arms. But he kept running into the wall because
yeah.
she kept saying,
where's
well, what
go?
Do you want? He That's says, right. no, it should be no arms because the church has a history of being open and whatnot. But he kept running into the wall of saying, well, what do you do? And you know, there's always been a question within the Black liberation movement about defense.
Yep.
Okay. Doesn't mean retaliation. It means defense.
That's right.
And so to me, that's a live question these days.
And it is one that I think really needs to be delved into a little bit more. Because
now, by the way, he did say it doesn't have to be arms, but it needs to be brothers in there that can protect.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can do that, fine. But I'm saying there's got to be defense.
Well, you know, we've seen historically where some folks have been patting you down and keeping an eye on you in their places of worship for a long time because they saw this coming.
Right.
Right. You know what I mean? So, you know, you have to be, I mean, you got to be realistic. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're out here challenging the status quo, which has been violent throughout its history. Right. And to maintain its order and control, then they will do it. Obviously, from slavery to lynchings to acts of domestic terrorism to keep you in line, then you have to understand that at any point that when you step out of that, you are a target.
You are a target.
Right. And so self-defense is common sense. And so what's wrong with you being able to defend yourself? Now, if you choose to do that through nonviolence, then that's fine. But the conversation is live. Mm-hmm. When it hits the fan, when the rubber meets the road, do you want to go to church and knowing that something like South Carolina is looming and something, they are vulnerable in the sense that who thought something like this would ever happen? Certainly you had the bombing of the church, and I think people were on high alert for a long time around that. Then it sort of dwindles, and then now we sort of like, okay, we feel like this is a safe place to go to. Now you have people walking into churches unloading on people in the church during Bible study. I don't feel comfortable going. Like, I don't care if I don't care if it's Love Corner, Jericho, Mount Olive. Knowing what I have been involved in, knowing who my wife is, knowing what's going on in the world, I think it's irresponsible for you not to be on alert in that regard. Right? You know.
And I'll up it for you, Aaron. I used to teach criminology for like 12 years. And one of the phenomena that you see with hate crimes or any kind of domestic, any kind of public terrorist or violence like that, is the problem of copycat. That's the thing.
It's a real issue.
Yeah. So it's a real, it's just a phenomenon. It's a criminological phenomena.
Okay.
That other crazy people get the same idea, and me too. So you see copycats all the time. So it only makes sense to be on alert.
Okay. We done struck a chord now. Here we go. Go ahead, caller. You on the air.
Hey, this is Stan. Reasonable Man Stan.
Reasonable Man Stan. Go ahead, Stan.
Yes. I think that once the dust settles on this South Carolina shooting, there's going to be a link. I think the shooter went there to kill the minister, because one of the first things he did was to ask if the minister was present.
Okay. So that would link, you're saying the link will be to what? You know, you're saying that definitely that was an intent. You think that he was sent there to strictly assassinate the minister, the who was an elected official?
I believe that's going to be part of it.
Okay. All right.
Well, the minister had proposed legislation for cops to wear body cameras. I mean, he was the one who pushed that. And the minister, who is a state representative, state senator, had pushed legislation for cops to wear body cameras after the killing of Walter Scott in Charleston, Alabama, too. So there was a public policy issue that this minister was associated with, too.
Mm.
Remember, he wasn't just the minister taking Carolyn to account. He was also a state representative.
Hey, thanks, Stan. I appreciate it, man.
He's a state senator, but yes, you're right. I think it was a yeah.
All right, thanks, Stan. I appreciate it.
Yep. Bye.
So, you know, what's interesting about what you said reminded me of Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory talks a lot about, listen, when you're dealing with race and racism, I'm not worried about this sort of what he calls redneck cracker, whoever, small town white boy that's, you know, mad at me or hating me because I'm black. My problem is with those who shape public policy,
right?
And create and harm thousands and millions of people, you know, through their public policies.
Right.
And so when you start talking about public policy that this minister, senator was working on, you're talking about, he's really digging at this police department and how they're going to be governed after this killing of the brother with Walter Scott. Is it Walter Scott?
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I don't particularly enjoy living in a space or mentally where I have to think the worst about every situation that I'm involved in. But when you talk about changing people's lives, affecting even the average white person who didn't agree with slavery, when you start talking about the economic impact that freeing slaves would have on them, they will quickly choose to keep slavery in place. And that would be for black folks, too, whoever it was, if you were talking about. Because when you talk about the prison system now, when you talk to the average person about the conditions of prison, about the inhumaneness of it or whatever, they can be like, oh, yeah, that's absolutely crazy. But if they are correctional guard, when you start talking about closing them, they're like, oh, no, you can't close TAMS.
Yeah.
One of the most inhumane facilities in the country.
Right.
But people who work there are like, you can't take my job. I don't, you know, when it comes to my job or how these people are treated, I'm going to choose my job every time. Right. You know what I mean? So you don't know how people will respond when you start talking about changing public policy,
especially
something that they hold near and dear to them.
Right.
You know, and so we should be mindful of that. And when we're doing things and talking, going back to this question of security and being clear about what role you play and what people might try to say and do to you based upon your position or your ability to affect public policy, you know.
There was a study I just came across, University of Chicago Law School study, which showed that indicated did a quantitative analysis showing that the public policy preferences of black people are rarely ever enacted. Of all groups in society, they are the least enacted public policies.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Carla, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is Representative Carol Emmons calling. I want to thank Lou for the last statement he just made. Over the last 5 months in the General Assembly in Illinois, I can attest to the last statement mm-hmm. Mr. Turner just made, that if we take all of the bills that we've tried to enact in the last 5 months, if they are pertaining to African Americans, they are usually rarely passed.
Exactly.
We had a couple of very important bills that were economic impact bills sponsored by Representative LaShawn Ford that did not pass. And this is a long-standing argument. Mm-hmm. The second thing I want to say is highlight that Brother Aaron brought up the issue of closing jails. On our this year's spring bills, one of them included reopening TAMS. And the argument from Representative Terry Bryant was, A, it was going to increase public safety in the jail system. They needed to open TAMS because of safety issues in other jails. And B, she said, overcrowding. I went to that criminal justice panel, which I am not on, chaired by Representative Sims. And from our work here in Champaign-Urbana, was prepared to argue down not only her resolution but her bill. We didn't call either one of them this session, but they are moving quickly to attempt to reopen TAM. And then the last thing I'll say is that the issue that we're experiencing here in South Carolina, my initial thought when I saw it is that, geez, this man is a state senator and a minister. I really thought that that really highlighted a couple of things, because I don't believe the gentleman who shot the victim in the church, I don't believe he's a lone gunman. I wanted to bring up the James Earl Ray situation with Dr. King, that the theory of lone gunmen does not allow you to dig deep enough to see who all was involved in the assassination of Dr. King. And here we are 40, 50 years later, dealing with this concept of the lone gunman. He was not a lone gunman, and if the proper investigation takes place, which I hope will, you will dig deep enough to see who the association and associates of that murder incident were and bring them to justice as well. So I just wanted to throw those out, and I'll continue to listen.
All right. Thanks a lot, sis. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
So just a real big old bag of stuff here, and we've still got about another 20 minutes to kind of sort of hone in on, I guess, a couple of different things. I thought that from my perspective, the history and the connection was very clear, and a lot of people really appreciated that. So that's sort of what I hope to accomplish with a radio program, is to get that type of information out there so we can amplify it through other means and get other people to understand the history. But so when you're thinking about this, what do you think the impact? You started talking about copycat a little bit, and to me, this seems like, you know, if you talk about copycat, you bring up you plant the seed for somebody to copycat, right? You know, but so talk a little bit more about why that's you said from a criminology standpoint that is a known phenomenon,
right,
that exists, and is it something that just sort of you see a spike and then it sort of dies off or something like that? Is that how that works or what?
Yeah, in a lot of different crimes, you'll see, for instance, young people committing suicide, you'll see like copycats. I mean, so one point of view from the point of public health is to try to limit the information in the media about such things, because kids get the idea. And then in that case, it becomes, you know,
shooting
a concern,
in the schools,
right,
and
shooting
all
in schools and whatnot. And we see that kind of thing. I think Carol is right about the lone gunman question. I was using lone wolf as just a way what they're talking about. So far as we don't know anything, I don't buy into it, but that's what's being used. It's to me, the issue, reality is often stranger than fiction.
Okay.
And in the sense that a lot of the discussion now in South Carolina is over the flag,
mm-hmm.
The Confederate flag and whatnot. Republican state senator said he was going to push, introduce legislation to get the flag taken down from the Capitol. But people talked about a range of issues mm-hmm. about South Carolina and particularly in Charleston that need to be dealt with, that created the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
The environment for this to happen. So in that regard, the idea of a lone gunman in this case, if you have an environment which, you know, kind of enables,
right.
facilitates this kind
produces.
Of thing, produces, then, you know, it's just a matter of time. And, mm-hmm. and what we see in the country, both in terms of gun violence of all kinds, and in terms of the racism and the kind of political polarization in the country, all of those become a mix that makes it scarier to me that quote-unquote lone gunmen or quote-unquote lone wolves are much more scarier than even organized, because you don't have to have an organization
right.
if you've created an environment in which anybody feels enabled
right.
to do it. I mean,
right.
that's a scarier scenario to me than even finding some organization that does it, blah, 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 but mm-hmm. because it can come from anywhere.
If that environment, which is a bigger picture than
right.
the organization itself,
right.
sort of creates the context. And there was some conversation around this is how the police killings all across right. the country have...
Speaking of copycat cops.
Right. See, right. So if the phenomenon and the principle of copycat exists for young students or teenagers who want to commit suicide or want to go into a school and shoot mm-hmm. up folks, the cops are people too.
Right.
And they have, some of them are disturbed mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder mm-hmm. and all, or just being a cop mm-hmm.
right.
for a long time and seeing a whole mm-hmm. bunch of stuff, right? They also are victim to, or they fall into that category where they could perpetuate a copycat, you know? And I think the point that you're making there is just, Some people want to create a space where some professions or cops or firemen, they're not a part of that particular no. group. You can't have that conversation about them. They're the good guys. That's not what we're saying. Mm-hmm. We're saying that they're subject to the same concerns or problems that any other human being
right.
is subject to. And so when I think about the context for the dehumanizing or the devaluing of black life, right? How do we talk about that? Is that the climate and culture that you're talking about, or are you talking about something specific to South Carolina? Are you talking about something broader when you talk about a climate and context that says it's okay to, or that a lone gunman or a lone wolf says, hey, you know what, I kind of believe in that ideology also. I feel empowered to go kill 9 people or go kill somebody some people in a theater or something like that because of the climate. So you're talking mm-hmm. about the country.
Right. I'm definitely talking about the country.
Okay.
I think that the term you use, empowered, is important. I mean, this society, the environment of this society, really does empower people on an individual basis mm-hmm. in a kind of rather contradictory way. On the one hand, they feel powerless,
uh-huh.
okay, mm-hmm. and they overcompensate for that by thinking that they can just take power and express it in the way that they do. And so the environment really is, to me, scarier than some organized conspiracy or not, because it can, like I said, it can come from anywhere
mm-hmm.
in that case, and places that, you know, you would not even expect it to come from.
Hmm.
That's a much more insecure situation. You feel much more vulnerable and exposed in that situation, which then from our point of view means what kind of vigilance do we have
mm-hmm.
in terms of
responding to that or defending
against that. And I think that's the kind of discussion the needs, I assume, will be happening in the churches. Maybe there'll be a rediscovery of what Black liberation theology means mm-hmm. amongst pastors who felt that they were immune. I mean, you're right. It is a whole new level than just church burnings. I mean, we've had that.
Yeah.
This takes it to a whole other level and whatnot. And you do look around now if you're mm-hmm. in church.
I mean, I just don't, you know, I don't. This is what I was saying earlier. I really feel like it's not a good day from my perspective when you say you live in a free society, but all your public places, you got to be wand down, padded down. You can't bring your cell phones. I mean, you know, when you just start to live in a place that everywhere you go,
right.
you have to be concerned about somebody just coming in here unloading on you, right? You know, or setting up a bomb. Now, it makes me think about how other people are living when you're worrying about some quote-unquote suicide bomber or you can't even go to the market and you're worrying about somebody blowing up everybody in a two-mile radius or something. Right. You know, where are we going, you know, if that's the society that you're going to live in? But
well, you know, Sundiata's doing that work on lynching and comparing it to the police shootings now. Mm-hmm. And that actually the shooting of unarmed Black people is at a higher rate than even at the height of lynching in the 1890s
right.
now.
Right.
And if you remember, I guess it was maybe 20 years ago, there was a photo exhibit display, a very famous one, about lynching in America. This photographer collected all these and put them in museums. And the title of it was called No Sanctuary.
No Sanctuary, that's right.
And that's what we're living. There is no sanctuary. The places that we considered sanctuaries, sacred spaces,
right.
no sanctuary.
I mean, I'm sitting there as an alderman in Urbana, and part of my routine for me, you know, is I'm not just listening to the information being given to me. I'm looking to see who's in the audience and who's walking back and forth past the doors.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and that's just, I don't know, is it just responsible? I mean, this is the time that you live in. These are the changes and the adjustments that you're going to have to make. Otherwise, I just feel like it's almost irresponsible for you to act as if it's not a possibility.
Right.
Right? You know what I mean? So there's this balance, I guess, I'm looking for between, you know, being on guard but enjoying the moment,
right?
You know, and maybe that's just where we're going, and that should be the mantra, you know.
It's going to take a social movement to really save this society, to bring it back from the brink, everywhere from climate change on down. I mean, the climate is makes us insecure. It's been changed. Capitalism is so destroyed the climate and the patterns of life that we have had. That's insecure now. So everything from the global climate all the way down to your neighborhood
mm-hmm.
becomes a place of insecurity. And it is only when there's going to be a mass movement to reclaim that that we're going to get any change. And the public policy piece is important, but there's really got to be a movement to push politicians and public officials to change. They're not going to do it on their own.
Well, I think that what we're going to have to come back and talk about at some point, maybe you and Sundi and whoever else, maybe even a nice debate on capitalism. Because what I just heard you say was that this nature of capitalism, which really pits those who have against those who have not, and it puts the police, for instance, in a position to protect those who have, right? as opposed to those who have not. The environment creates this hostility. Then the lack of employment opportunities and all that kind of stuff creates poverty and creates violence and crime and all kind of, you know, because this young man, you're taking our country,
right?
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Raping our women, taking our country. What you're saying is that the opportunities that once were all mine, now I have to share.
Right.
And so as opposed to going to somebody else who's really got more than their share, right? You're going to come and take it out on me when I'm just trying to survive just like everybody else is.
And he was wearing the symbols of it, Rhodesia and South Africa. And that said it all.
Wow. Hey, listen, Lou, we only got about 10 minutes left here, but it's gone by really, really fast this morning, which tells me that this has been I've enjoyed the show. I hope that others out there listening have also enjoyed the show. What I hear a lot when I'm watching a panel of folks who are just not even communicating to me, they're just sort of yapping back and forth with each other, is a lot of emotion and a lot of different emotions around the killings in South Carolina, especially on the heels of the killing of the brother by the police officer. But I don't get the clarity that I got from you today, right? You know, and I'm searching for that. I think other people, whether they're searching for it or not, we need that sort of historical context to understand how we got here, right? Otherwise, you'll just be responding to what you see right in front of you, and you'll be blind. Right. You'll be moving in a very blind state, in a very maybe even ill-motivated state or emotional response to something. So I really appreciate you coming and bringing the level of clarity that you've brought to the and the history that you've brought to this. And certainly, if the article is ready to be shared with other people, so I'll send that to you, Sandra. Also, the article that Lou did, and so the books that I have are Notable Black American Men and Women. So that's the encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. You have to read that in your library. Mm-hmm. Archibald Grimke's The Martyrs of 1822. Mm-hmm. If we Google John Killens, John Lofton, we should get some material from them as well. Right. Sterling Stuckey, Slave Culture and Development of Black Consciousness is one that we would have that you would also recommend as readings for folks. Man, this is it's always a ton of stuff that we can get into, but I thought this was a good piece. And to everybody who's listening, I thought that the first followers program was today. It's actually next Saturday from 10 to 1 at Bethel AME Church for the job readiness piece that I spoke of earlier. So that's actually next Saturday from 10 to 1 at Bethel. Job readiness being done by first followers, Brother Marlon Mitchell and James Kilgore. David Walker's appeal is also something that folks should read as well. And just for the last couple of minutes, is it just irony that it's Juneteenth? The celebration that we're having this conversation, because I think the targeting of Bethel, of Mother Emanuel, was not in relationship to Juneteenth, but more in relationship to the history of Bethel. Talk to me about that a little bit.
I'll show you a stranger irony to it. When the rebellion was discovered that Denmark VC had organized, and remember, the original date was supposed to be on Bastille Day, French Revolution, July 14th. When it was discovered, he got together his lieutenant. He says, "Let's move up the date." The date was going to be June 18th.
June 18th.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Irony or not, I don't know.
So Juneteenth, the Emancipation Proclamation in Texas, is Galveston, Texas, in what year?
1865.
Yeah. Okay.
So because it was two years after the emancipation was signed. Yeah.
Right. So there's no way that Denmark VC knew anything.
No, there was no
Juneteenth or whatever. That's just irony of history and how it falls on the 18th. Right. And then so June 19th, basically 1867?
65
is when we get the
Juneteenth
in Galveston, Texas. And so 12 to 3 today, you all come over to Douglas Center, to Douglas Park. There's going to be some festivities, cultural festivities around Juneteenth. You can learn a lot more. Stop by and get a little history, get a little African culture, and hang out with folks. And let's get to know each other, because this social movement from people of goodwill is going to be necessary in order for us to save our society. So I want to thank you, Dr. Lou, for coming down, hanging out with me for a little while. It's always real. I know Gabe and them are running you crazy, got you running all over the place. But is there anything else you wanted to say before we get out of here? We got a couple minutes.
No, I just think that we really have got to. There's been a Black Lives Matter movement that's developing, and I think it has to really broaden and take on the complexity of the moment that we're living in, really deal with a whole range of issues.
That was the thing that I was wanting to touch on, because the whole Black Lives Matter piece, the devaluing of black life, right? How does that fit into even, because we get into these conversations and we talk about the state-sanctioned violence by the police or capital punishment and stuff like that. And then as soon as I get into that conversation, I corner somebody on that, they say, well, what about all this black-on-black crime? Mm-hmm. What's the response to something like that? Are we talking about two different things, or is there a real principle issue in there that we ought to face head on?
I was just reading an essay. It's obviously a large, too large issue to go into a few minutes, but his brother just wrote an essay called Perfect Storm.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts together all of those things in terms of they're all connected and whatnot. And so it's created a perfect storm that the black community.
Mm-hmm. So there's an article out there called Perfect Storm.
Yeah, Perfect Storm. It's in the Journal of Critical Sociology.
Well, you know, to all my brothers and sisters in the barbershops and beauty salons and riding in your car listening, we know that there's historically been this tension between the way it's described as a tension between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, which would almost be a academics, professionals, doctors like Lou versus Aaron Emmons and Martell Miller. And what I say is that, no, there's a perfect union between those two, because we need both, right? We want these brothers and sisters working, and we also want everybody to be well read and all that type of stuff.
Go ahead,
Carla, you're on the air.
Okay. On the question of Juneteenth Day, there was, at the time, there was some confusion over what the day was. Now, Galveston is an island, so parts of the island were, you know, so that's why it's called Juneteenth. It may have been on the 18th. It may have been on the 19th. Okay. And as far as summer reading, I would recommend Robert F. Williams' book, Negroes with Guns. And remember that the black Muslims had the fruit of Islam as their defense cards. Defense is necessary for all of us. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate your comments.
He took exile in Cuba, I think, and made radio programs that I've been trying to search out, broadcasting. Radio Free Dixie or something?
What was the name again?
Robert Williams?
Robert Williams, yeah.
Niggas with Guns.
Okay, y'all. All right, so we got 4 minutes left. I want to thank everybody for calling down. Appreciated all the calls in. Get out today. Go to your farmer's market. Go get you some fresh produce to help create the environment, the society that you want to live in, regardless of your profession, regardless of your ethnicity, your socioeconomic status, your sexual orientation. It does not matter. If you want a particular society, then we need to be conscientious and intentional about the society that we want to create. Otherwise, as you can see, it's becoming a place of no sanctuary. Paul.
The level of the discourse today on NPR, a so-called criminologist was interviewed by Scott Simon, and it just, I hit the ceiling.
Yeah, I know, I heard it.
He said, oh, man, I mean, I was one. Well, let me try explain it, because before I get apoplectic and lose it, he was saying that those decals of Rhodesia and South Africa, they might have just been cool. They were just cool.
Yeah,
white supremacy is cool. Yeah,
get the
hell. I mean, what the hell is it?
I know, I heard it.
Somebody, we need a Twitter storm to go after that.
Well, you know, one of the things I did notice, and this is an interesting conversation, I think, to some degree, about how the young man is being labeled. We're very intentional. People are very intentional about saying, hey, he's racist, he's a domestic terrorist, he's a kid, he was mentally unstable and stuff like that. And I think about principally a 21-year-old period. Our society says you can't even get liquor until you turn 21, right? You know, there's something about being responsible at that age. Do I want young African-American men who are between the ages of 16 and 25 or whatever, they haven't gone through that stage of development yet, to be labeled as children or as young men who are misguided or whatever? You know, how do I want all of our young people, from a sociologist standpoint, or there's a stage in which they say we actually start to develop, and there's still some lack of development mentally up to a certain point for us as human beings, male versus female, all that kind of stuff. I'm just saying that, is it appropriate basically to refer to him as a kid, or is this, or no, you are, that's just not an excuse. We're not giving you a label as a kid. You are a murderer, a terrorist, a sociopath, whatever, and that's just what you are, regardless of how old you are.
So from a criminological point of view, that's why we have two criminal criminal justice systems. We have juvenile, because, for the reasons you just gave, and adult. This is an adult.
Except that breaks down all the time.
It breaks down all the time. Black male breaks down all the time.
You get charged as an adult.
So black males are always, we always have that problem. I got an 11-year-old kid at home, and because he's as tall as he will always be viewed as an adult by the police. I mean, that's, so the narrative that's, you know, being created around this guy is to essentially make him a juvenile, and somehow, because juvenile delinquency is somehow you're not responsible totally
for
all of your actions.
All right, so my time is winding down, and I have thoroughly enjoyed myself. Paul, I want to thank you, as usual, for causing a little trouble, stirring up some stuff, as usual. Trying to think, is there anything else I'm supposed to be announcing? I do want people out there to think about this Parkland College Highway Construction Careers Training Program. It's a free 14-week program. The start dates are August 11th of this year. Orientation dates are July 8th, 9th, 8th and the 9th at 2 p.m. This is a free 14-week construction career training program. And all the conversations that I'm having now with all of these different skilled trades is that you go through this program, even though it doesn't guarantee you a job, it puts you in a position where you learn more than you know now, which better positions you to get into one of the trades. In particular, the iron worker said to me that when you take welding, it gives you some a leg up in the interview process or this application process. This is a free 14-week program to teach you about laborers, equipment operators, iron workers, carpenters, cement masons,